Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Saturday, April 18, 2020. City, Medical Lodge resident is county's third death. 42nd confirmed case is staff member at the long-term care facility. By Caitlin Randall. The third Midland County resident who died from complications related to coronavirus was one of five residents at Midland Medical Lodge who contracted the virus, a city spokeswoman confirmed Friday. The woman in her 90s was the third resident at the facility confirmed to have the coronavirus. She was transported to Midland Memorial Hospital on Wednesday. The City of Midland said in a press release that no other details would be released at the request of the patient's family. The four other residents are currently inpatients at the hospital and include a woman in her 70s, a woman in her 80s, a man in his 80s, and a man in his 70s. Seven employees have been confirmed positive for the virus, four administrative employees who are isolating at home, one part-time nurse in her 30s who is an inpatient at Midland Memorial, a staff member in her 50s who is isolating at home, and a staff member in her 30s who is also isolating at home. The 30-year-old staff member is the 42nd confirmed case. She has not worked since April 10, according to a press release from the city. It is unclear when the administrative employees contracted the virus because the City of Midland Health Department did not alert the public of the cases until after a resident at Midland Medical Lodge had tested positive. Family members and residents were not made aware of the confirmed cases either, according to a previous Reporter Telegram article. Health Department officials said during a press release Thursday that the first staff member to test positive was confirmed on April 3. They have not provided a timeline for when the other administrative employees were confirmed positive, or the ages of those employees. When reached by phone, a Health Department employee said he was not authorized to answer questions and that they were told to direct inquiries to the city's public information officer. All residents of Midland Medical Lodge were tested Friday, MMH CEO Russell Meyer said during a press briefing. He said testing the residents would help the hospital to prepare for a possible influx of new patients. Myers also said 14 residents at the nursing home have been placed in an isolation wing at the facility, designed to be similar to the COVID-19 ward at the hospital. He previously said that isolation unit would be used to quarantine residents displaying symptoms of the virus. Nursing homes are one of the most common sources of outbreak nationwide. The New York Times reported Friday there have been 6,900 nursing home deaths in the U.S. related to COVID-19. Meyer said Midland Memorial has begun contacting other nursing homes in the community to gauge how prepared the facilities are for infections and if there are any residents currently displaying symptoms. He said no facilities have reported symptomatic residents other than Manor Park, who reported one resident. A man in his 90s at the facility was confirmed positive on Wednesday. A receptionist at Midland Medical Lodge said she was not authorized to answer questions. Messages left for administrative employees at the facility were not returned. Energy. Oil prices close below $19 a barrel. Crude loses 8.1% this week. By Mella McEwen. M. McEwen at MRT.com. Markets were unimpressed with last weekend's agreement by 23 nations, including members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, Russia and Mexico, to cut 9.7 million barrels a day of crude production. After beginning the week at $22 a barrel, West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange fell below the $19 level, a level not seen since 2002. Crude dropped $1.60, or 8.1%, to end the week at $18.27 a barrel. The posted price was lowered $1.75 to $14.75 a barrel. Oil prices have now lost 70% since the beginning of the year. Posted prices may be $18 a barrel, but with the Midland-Cushing differential and transportation costs, we are getting more like $12 a barrel at the wellhead. David Bledsoe, president of Henry Resources, told the Reporter-Telegram in an email. Regarding Henry, we are very fortunate to be fully hedged this year, so we are okay. No layoffs or salary cuts, but we are the exception and not the rule. We will, however, be curtailing the vast majority of our production and basically storing it in the ground, waiting for higher prices. Natural gas prices had a better week. After falling below $1.60 per MCF on the NYMEX, prices rebounded almost 7 cents Friday to close at $1.75 per MCF. Bloomberg attributed Friday's oil price drop to continued gloomy demand forecasts and a cratering physical market. China's economy suffered a historic slump in the first quarter as the coronavirus outbreak threatened global markets for its goods, the news service reported. Meanwhile, OPEC predicted demand for its oil will fall to the lowest level in 3 decades. Refiners from Japan to Indonesia are canceling or delaying crude purchases, and European processors have requested big cuts in Saudi supply for next month. With the recent reduced output deal by OPEC and its partners failing to revive prices, Saudi Arabia and Russia have said they'll continue to closely monitor the oil market and are prepared to take further measures jointly with OPEC Plus and other producers if these are deemed necessary. Bloomberg said, Saudi Aramco said Friday that it will reduce supply to 8.5 million barrels a day from May 1. We're seeing record cuts, but still not enough to bring the market even close to balance, Warren Patterson, head of commodity strategy at ING Bank NV, told Bloomberg. Even OPEC's own numbers showed that. It's a continuation of the story. In its April 2020 update to its short-term energy outlook, the Energy Information Administration forecasts that U.S. crude production will average 11.8 million barrels a day this year, down 4% from 2019 levels and average 11 million barrels a day in 2021, down 6% from 2020. The EIA said this will mark the first annual decrease since 2016. The majority of the decline will occur between the first and fourth quarters of the year, dropping from 12.7 million barrels in the fourth quarter to 11 million barrels, or 13%, in the fourth quarter, and remaining at that level through 2021. Typically, the EIA forecast notes, oil price changes impact production after about 6 months. However, current market conditions, combined with significantly reduced demand as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, will likely decrease this lag, as many producers have already announced plans to cut capital spending and drilling levels. Standoff on Loop 250. City, man being held on weapons, drug charges, from staff reports. A 44-year-old man is being held Friday on federal weapon and drug charges after surrendering to police Friday morning, according to a press release from the city spokeswoman. Eddie Villa also was charged with stalking and evading. The incident began about 3:30 a.m. Friday when police were dispatched on a stalking call to the area of Big Spring Street and Florida Avenue. The vehicle described by dispatch was located and a pursuit ensued. The pursuit ended west of Big Spring Street on the North Service Road of Loop 250, according to the release. The Midland Police Department tactical team was called out to the scene, and after a few hours of negotiations, Villa surrendered, according to the release. There were no injuries. The investigation is continuing. Midland unemployment jumps to 3.1%, by Mella McEwen, mmcewen at mrt.com. Midland unemployment increased between February and March as the economic impact of falling oil and gas activity and from the coronavirus pandemic began to impact the Midland labor market. The Texas Workforce Commission said Friday the unemployment rate in its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, which includes Midland and Martin counties, jumped to 3.1% in March from 2.3% and is well above the 2% reported in March 2019. In the Commission's Odessa MSA, the unemployment rate climbed to 4.4% from 3.3% in February and above the 2.4% of March 2019. This is not a true reflection of what we're seeing in our offices, Willie Taylor, Chief Executive Officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions, Permian Basin, said in a phone interview. We know May and June will give us a truer picture. The unemployment rate could easily be 6% or more. The impact of low oil prices on the area's oil and gas companies, combined with the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, have had a tremendous impact. No one was prepared for this, he said. Taylor said 100% of calls coming into his offices are related to unemployment. In addition, he said the number of continuous claims his office handles has gone from about 1,600 a month to 3,200 a month. And I see that going to be around 6,000 next month, he said. Then we'll see a true reflection as people who qualify under state unemployment insurance and those who now qualify under the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act file will see the count go up. With the layoffs in Midland and Odessa, he said his offices are getting applications for Walmart, HEB, Albertsons Market, Market Street, Family Dollar, and construction projects are continuing, he said. Everyone is concerned with, at what point will we return to normal, and what will normal look like? I don't want to be resorting to virtual programming indefinitely. We're used to being face-to-face. When things return to normal, he said, we will still have skill shortages. Taylor said he has been in the workforce for 48 years and has never seen anything like what is happening. We know we will come out of this. It will take time, he said. While Taylor has had to pull the plug on some training initiatives and canceled some summer programs, he is working on a $3.2 million grant to provide training for dislocated workers. When we do come back, they will want and need training, he said. We need to plan ahead. Midland's civilian labor force fell by 2,000 from February to March, dropping to 108,995 from 111,020. The number of employed Midlanders sank by 2,800. Total non-farm jobs fell by 400 from 114,400 to 114,000. The MSA's dominant industry sector, mining, logging, and construction, added 200 jobs to 39,100, the only sector to add jobs from February to March. Professional and business services led job losses with 300, followed by the trade, transportation, and utility sector, the financial activity sector, and the leisure and hospitality sector, which each lost 100 jobs. For the 12 months between March 2019 and March 2020, total non-farm jobs rose by 600. The mining, logging, and construction sector shed 1,400 jobs during that period, followed by the government and manufacturing sectors, which each lost 200 jobs. Professional and business services led, adding 800 jobs, followed by trade, transportation, and utilities with 700 new jobs. The leisure and hospitality sector added 400 jobs, and the financial activities and other services sectors each added 200 jobs. Statewide, the unemployment rate rose to 4.7%. 14 residents in isolation at Midland Medical Lodge. All of the long-term care facility's residents will be tested for virus, MMH CEO says, by Caitlin Randall. See Randall at MRT.com. 14 residents of Midland Medical Lodge are being quarantined in an isolation wing at the facility after 5 other residents and 7 employees were confirmed positive for the coronavirus this week. Midland Memorial Hospital officials have made the decision to test all residents of the nursing home in light of the high number of confirmed positives and suspected cases, MMH CEO Russell Meyer said during a press briefing Friday. We have been in contact with those folks over the last several days and yesterday made a decision to send a team from the hospital to Midland Medical Lodge, where they are at this moment testing the remainder of the resident population there to see what we are dealing with and to do our best to try to predict what hospital volume may be coming from that outbreak, he said. Meyer said they should have those test results back by the beginning of next week, and then they'll have a better sense of how that outbreak will affect the hospital. 4 of the residents who tested positive for COVID-19 are inpatients in the hospital. There are two men and two women in their 70s and 80s. The fifth resident, a female in her 90s, died Friday, the City of Midland confirmed. Midland Memorial's case management team began contacting other nursing homes in the community and the surrounding area on Thursday, Meyer said. He said they asked the facilities if any residents are displaying symptoms, how much personal protective equipment they have available, and how prepared they are to manage any infections. Of the nursing homes they spoke with, only Manor Park reported having a confirmed or suspected case, Meyer said. There was one resident, male in his 90s, who was confirmed positive on Wednesday. We want to know what's happening in the community and do the best we can to anticipate cases that might be ahead of us in the next few days, he said. We're going to continue to be very, very assertive in keeping up with the populations in the nursing homes. Meyer said Wednesday that Midland Medical Lodge had created an isolation wing, similar to the COVID-19 ward in the hospital, to house any residents who experienced symptoms of the virus. Only a small number of residents had been isolated at that time, Meyer said Wednesday. Area nursing homes like Midland Medical Lodge have been affected by the coronavirus. 14 residents of Midland Medical Lodge are being quarantined in an isolation wing at the facility, and 5 other residents and 7 employees were confirmed positive for the coronavirus this week. ECHD reports 2 more deaths, 3 more virus cases, from staff reports. Ector County Precinct 1 Commissioner Eddie Shelton said during a Zoom conference that the Ector County Health Department has reported 2 more coronavirus-related deaths on Friday. ECHD also reported 3 more confirmed cases, bringing the total to 58. Ector County also reported its first 3 pediatric patients, a 4-month-old, 11, and 13. The department has tested 612 negative cases, 223 tests are pending, and 893 tests have been given total. Medical Center Health System President and CEO Russell Tippin said MCH reported their 2nd and 3rd deaths in the last 24 hours. MCH has tested 32 positive people. There are 2 positive patients in critical care and 1 on a ventilator. 2 other positive patients are on the isolation floor. The hospital is treating 8 persons under investigation, with 1 of those patients in critical care and the other 7 on the isolation floor. The hospital has 166 pending tests. Of those, 107 are from Madison Medical Resort. MCH has tested 246 cases as well. Odessa Regional Medical Center President and CEO Stacy Brown said 239 tests have been given in total. ORMC has had 9 positive tests and 115 negative. There are 115 pending tests, with 98 pending tests from the Madison Medical Resort. Ector County by the numbers. Confirmed cases, 58. Days since first case confirmed, 21. By gender. Male, 22. Female, 36. Age group. 0 to 19, 3. 20 to 29, 9. 30 to 39, 11. 40 to 49, 11. 50 to 59, 14. 60 to 69, 8. 70 to 79, 2. Source of exposure, travel-related, 4. Person-to-person, 36. Unknown, 18. City, man in wheelchair dies after being hit, from staff reports. A man in a wheelchair died Thursday night after being hit by an SUV, according to a press release from the city spokeswoman. The man was crossing Florida northbound in the 700 block of East Florida Avenue and was not in a crosswalk, according to the release. The driver of the SUV was traveling westbound in the outside lane of Florida and hit the man. The man was transported to Midland Memorial Hospital, where he died. The driver of the SUV remained at the scene and was cooperative. No charges are pending, according to the release. Police and fire departments were dispatched at about 9 p.m. Thursday. The victim's name had not been released as of press time because next of kin had not been notified. The man is the 12th person to die this year in wrecks on roads in Midland County and the 3rd this month, according to Reporter Telegram records. Two people died April 7 in a three-vehicle wreck in the 1900 block of East Interstate 20, according to a previous Reporter Telegram article. Gas prices down nearly $1 from a year ago, by Stuart Doreen. S. Doreen at HearstNP.com. Midlanders are paying, on average, 93 cents less for a gallon of gas compared to 1 year ago. AAA Texas reported this week that the average in Midland was $1.82 a gallon, which is the highest in the state, more than 13 cents behind the average in Odessa, 25 cents above the state average, but nearly $1 less a gallon compared to the $2.75 average drivers in Midland were paying in mid-April 2019. There wasn't much of a difference in Midland and the rest of the state, as the average price drop in Midland, 6 cents, matched the drop in the state average. The average in Midland was 1 cent greater than Odessa. That stopped a trend going back to the end of February because the average in Odessa dropped more than the average in Midland. There is still a difference between the two cities that are 18 miles apart. One reason for Midland's higher gas prices, compared to Odessa, is the low and the high. Midland's lowest price, according to TexasGasPrices.com, is $1.64. In Odessa, the lowest price is $1.44. And there were more than 30 stations on Thursday with lower prices than Midland's lowest price. Midland also has 6 retailers with a low price of $1.99 or above. In Odessa, the number of stations is 4, according to TexasGasPrices.com. Distributors have told the Reporter Telegram there are many complexities in the fuel business that impact pricing. They pointed to the high cost of transportation from the Gulf Coast refineries and Midland's distance from pipelines. AAA Texas reported this week that the statewide average pump price has plummeted to the lowest level since February 2016. The organization also stated that Texas has the 11th least expensive gas prices in the country and that in the last 20 years, the lowest level the Texas statewide average dropped to was $1.02, which was set on December 26, 2001. Gasoline prices have been on a steady decline around the Lone Star State since late February, said AAA Texas spokesman Daniel Armbruster in an email. And while the crude oil production cut is historic, it's likely to not have an immediate impact on pump prices given the ongoing impact the COVID-19 pandemic continues to have on crude oil prices and gasoline demand. The lowest average in the state was $1.19 in Sherman-Denison, and the state average fell to $1.63. AAA Texas reported the following average prices across the region: $1.35 in Abilene, a decrease of 10 cents, $1.51 in Amarillo, a decrease of 6 cents, $1.57 in San Angelo, a decrease of 7 cents, $1.62 in Lubbock, a decrease of 7 cents, and $1.65 in El Paso, a decrease of 4 cents. Highest averages in the state. This week, Midland, $1.82, Odessa, $1.69, Corpus Christi, $1.69, Laredo, $1.68, College Station, Bryan, $1.67, state average, $1.57. Last week, Midland, $1.88, Odessa, $1.74, Laredo, $1.73, College Station, Bryan, $1.72, Corpus Christi, $1.72, state average, $1.63. Source, AAA Texas. Permian rig count sinks to under 300, from staff reports. Rig counts plunged for a third consecutive week, falling to levels not seen since the heart of the energy downturn in 2016. Baker Hughes said its weekly U.S. rig count plunged by 73 rigs to 529. Texas led the decline with 40 rigs being laid down during the week for a rig count of 262. The state still has more than half the nation's active drilling rigs. New Mexico's rig count is 84, down 9. The Permian Basin saw its rig count sink by 33 to 283 for the week. Eddy County, New Mexico, remains the most active in the Permian with 46 rigs, down 2 from the previous week. Lee County, New Mexico, follows with 38 rigs, down 6 from last week. Midland County recorded the steepest drop in rig activity for the week, dropping 8 rigs to stand at 31. Martin County had 29 rigs, down 1. Loving County dropped 6 rigs to 22, and Howard County lost 2 to 20. Reeves County fell 4 rigs to 18, followed by Upton County, down 1 to 15. Pecos and Ward counties each had 11 rigs this week, down 1 for Pecos and 2 for Ward. Andrews County recorded the highest gain, adding 2 rigs to 3, while Glasscock and Winkler counties gained 1 rig for a total of 9.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, April 18th, 2020, Section A. Local Family Battles Virus by Michael Merlot. During Friday's virtual hospital press conference, County Commissioner Eddie Shelton said that the four-month-old patient who tested positive with COVID-19 was living with his grandmother, who had tested positive, and 3 of the 4 children in that family have tested positive. Shelton said that the four-month-old was tested after Emergency Operations Center contact tracers located the family. A four-month-old boy, 13-year-old girl, and 11-year-old girl all tested positive for COVID-19 Thursday, the Ector County Health Department website detailed. Although the website says that the exposure is listed as unknown, Shelton said that they were exposed by the grandmother, which is person-to-person exposure. County Health Department Director Brandy Garcia did not participate in the Zoom conference. When asked what treatment looks like for patients that young, Medical Center Hospital Chief of Staff and Interim Medical Officer Dr. Donald Davenport said, "In medicine, we talk about treating pediatric patients as pediatrics and adults as adults, but in a lot of symptomatology and such, we're going to treat them the same." Davenport said that if a pediatric patient is having no respiratory problems, but is still running a fever with a cough, and they have the capability of being at home, they should be quarantined just as any other patient, but that a parent would need to be more readily available and possibly apply PPE to prevent the parent from being contaminated from the virus. If that child then should develop symptoms that require hospitalization, we're going to have to stratify those risk factors to decide where we can take care of that individual. MCH Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Timmons said that MCH's pediatric department is set up to care for those persons under interest, and they also have a direct relationship with Covenant Medical Center in Lubbock. She added that they have a Covenant doctor in-house 24/7, and when they are not in our building, they have a response time of 30 minutes. However, the bulk of them now are staying on campus, she said. She also said that for pediatric patients, MCH has a direct bed placement for them at Covenant in the event that they would need it. We are set up currently within our pediatric unit to care for those people, as well as the ability to move them up to an intermediate level where they could get heart monitoring. Davenport said it would be harder for parents to notice symptoms in children as young as 4 months old, and so it's going to be more of watching that child or problems of respiratory distress or worsening of a cough, higher fevers, lethargy, or not acting right. Those may be some of the things that they're going to watch for. Odessa Regional Medical Center Chief Medical Officer Rohith Saravanan said that ORMC currently doesn't have a pediatric unit active, and they closed it down to convert the area for COVID-19 related care. Saravanan said that supportive care is very important for kids, and that so far the pediatric population hasn't been affected as severely as older populations, but if they did get a patient, they would send them to pediatric specialty hospitals. Shelton, who was present in place of EOC members like Ector County Health Department Director Brandy Garcia and County County Commissioner Dale Childers said that Ector County has 58 positive cases, 612 negative cases, 223 pending, 23 recovered, and 893 total people tested. He said that there have been 4 deaths in Ector County. Ector County hospitals have reported 5 deaths, but only 4 were Ector County residents. The EOC and Health Department only report data on Ector County residents. MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin said that MCH has 32 positives, 2 in CCU and 1 on a ventilator, as well as 2 others on another COVID-19 designated floor. There have been 256 negatives, he said, 166 pending test results, and 107 of those pending are from Madison Medical Resort Nursing Home. Tippin said that MCH has had 3 deaths in the last 24 hours from Thursday to Friday. MCH has 8 persons under investigation in the hospital, one of whom is in CCU, and 7 are on the other designated floor. ORMC President Stacy Brown said that ORMC has tested 239 patients, 9 positives, 115 negatives, and 115 pending, she said. 98 of those pending are from Madison Medical Resort, which is an Odessa nursing home that had a positive on a patient under their care Thursday. Sarah Vannon said Governor Abbott's order is almost exactly the same as the previous order regarding the medical facilities, but with one extra exception, which basically says a hospital can write a letter to the Department of Health certifying 2 things. 1, that we are reserving 25% of the hospital's capacity to take care of COVID-19 related cases. And 2, that we will not ask any state, federal, or local organizations for any PPE for the entire duration of the COVID-19 pandemic, he said. We are still processing that, he added. We don't know if we're ready to do any of that yet, but we are definitely wanting to take care of the community, definitely wanting to get some of those surgeries back in the hospital and start doing them. So if we just figure out how to do it, I don't think we have an answer yet for that, but we are processing. Sarah Vannon said that ORMC has received the rapid test machine, but the state decides where the testing kits are going. As of right now, we're being told we'll receive 2 testing kits. Each kit can run 24 tests. That means we'll get 48 tests. I don't know when we'll get them, he said. He added that if and when ORMC gets them, they will use those tests for the CDC guidelines. Tippin said MCH will receive around the same amount of tests as ORMC. Shelton said that he could not comment on the drive-through testing facility until a plan was in place. When asked why Garcia and Childers were not in attendance, Shelton said that he will be the representative of the Ector County Health Department and the EOC from now on, and that daily COVID-19 updates will be sent out by email along with the virtual briefings. The head of the Emergency Operations Center, Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes, has not attended a hospital press conference for more than a week. County eyes department cuts and mass testing. With an anticipated strain on resources coming in the next budget cycle, Ector County department officials were asked to come up with areas to cut now. During an emergency meeting Friday, commissioners also heard about mass testing and scaling down of the Emergency Command Center. Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons' departments were asked to find things in the current budget cycle to save funds to roll into next year. He said there will be budget cuts next year, but they were asking to find reductions this year, so there could be savings now and the cuts wouldn't be as large next year. Simmons said layoffs and salary cuts have been on the table. He said the county has about 3 months of reserves, or $15 to $20 million, but they don't want to use it if they don't have to. We've got some departments that are physically closed down right now, so we talked about furloughing or laying off individuals in those areas, like the library or Coliseum, that aren't open to the public right now anyway, Simmons said. We have not taken that action just yet, but it still could happen. Then we've got departments that are operating on half staff and things like that. My concern is from a taxpayer point of view. They're still paying for salaries for full-time work, even though many of them are not being able to work right now. So that's what we were asking. Hey, if you're operating at half staff, maybe we furlough some of those individuals to save money for next year when we will need them back for full-time service. But most departments obviously don't want to lay their people off, and I understand that. In areas where there is a hiring freeze, open positions won't be filled right now. And maybe with turnover in general, Simmons said, they could wind up creating some savings. As for individual salaries of commissioners, Simmons said the commissioner's court has reduced its staff. A full-time person was allocated to the Emergency Operations Center, and one person is part-time. At this point, nobody's been asked for reducing salaries, including us, Simmons said. Health, information technology, the detention center, sheriff's office, medical examiner's office, and emergency management related to the COVID-19 pandemic have been exempted. Simmons said Sheriff Mike Griffiths did offer some cuts. He said the jail and juvenile detention center have a mandated number of personnel, and we don't want the sheriff to not hire a deputy if we need a deputy to patrol the streets, so we felt like that was one of the areas, law enforcement, that would be exempt, and the juvenile detention center as well, because they've got mandates for staffing levels too, Simmons said. Precinct 1 Commissioner Eddie Shelton said the cuts were voluntary right now. We all know what's coming next year, and there's no escaping it. It was hard. We worked our tails off, and still it's a tough plan. We don't want anybody to lose their job, Shelton said. He added that he recommends that if a position can remain vacant, don't fill it. Shelton said departments should start the process now. If you can transfer an employee from your department to a department that is overburdened and allowed to fill an open position, transfer to that department. That way we don't have layoffs. The state doesn't want layoffs. They don't want any more burden on their unemployment. And we have in our budget already to pay for these through this year. So I just want to find ways to fill open positions that are allowed to be filled from within, and nobody loses their job, Shelton said. The court also discussed setting up a drive-through testing center at the Coliseum. County Judge Debbie Hayes said the goal is to get it up and running by the end of April. She said the final phases of planning are still being ironed out. It will be staffed by a combination of ECISD nurses, UTPB nursing personnel, and Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. Dr. Timothy Benton, Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, said the idea was to do the testing by appointment. How many tests will depend on how the resources flow. He said an average of 25 phone calls go with each positive case for contact tracing. The county has received a $25,000 donation from Odessa businessman John Bushman to finance the testing. All along, this whole struggle for everyone has been getting that testing material. We do have a commitment from a lab to provide that testing material. They have a certain quota that they can provide. Currently, I suspect that will ramp up as more is manufactured. The other thing is testing will probably switch in the next couple of months. We'll be looking at immunoglobulin or antibody testing probably when that becomes available, Benton said. Commissioner Precinct 3, Dale Childers, said he thinks the important thing is to differentiate between the testing hospitals are doing, because that's based on medical necessity. These people are sick. This is going to be driven strictly by epidemiology, which is trying to get a snapshot of who's positive, who's negative, and figure out how we can best control it through containment, Childers said. Benton said he suspects that in the next month or so, officials are going to start thinking about sending people back to work. We may have another little blip in cases, so we probably need to look at this for 2 or 3 months in running this, Benton said. On scaling down the EOC, Hayes said it is because they have been very successful. It's time for us to kind of scale down, and we'll do it virtually. And as the hospital calls us and tells us there is a need for us, or they need additional supplies or support, then we'll gear back up, she said. Footage released of stabbing suspect. The Odessa Police Department has released surveillance footage of the person who was reportedly involved in a fatal stabbing of a 52-year-old man that happened early Friday morning. OPD released the surveillance footage on its website at tinyurl.com/Y8ZSC5PT. An OPD press release detailed the fatal stabbing happened at 12:54 a.m. in the 2500 block of North Tom Green Avenue. The victim was identified as 52-year-old Eddie Hernandez Palma. Investigation reportedly showed Palma was stabbed by an unknown person. He was transported to a local hospital and later pronounced deceased by medical personnel. Next of kin were notified. As of Friday morning, no arrests have been made and there are no suspects, the press release detailed. Anyone with information about the fatal stabbing is asked to contact OPD at 432-333-3641 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS. Local and state news roundup. Police searching for men connected to hotel robbery. The Odessa Police Department is reportedly looking for 2 men involved in a robbery at a hotel in downtown Odessa. The reported robbery happened March 17th at the Marriott Hotel and Convention Center, 305 East 5th, an OPD press release detailed. Investigation reportedly showed 2 men stole an employee's backpack, which had more than $900 worth of property. OPD has released a photo of the 2 men that can be seen at tinyurl.com/Y87PY25D. Anyone with information about the robbery is asked to contact Detective L. Gonzalez at 432-335-3345 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS and reference case number 20-05735. Woman charged with assaulting husband with box cutter. A 37-year-old woman was arrested after she reportedly cut her husband multiple times with a box cutter. An Odessa Police Department affidavit stated that Mary Lynn Barbie, 37, was arrested and charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, family violence, a second-degree felony. The affidavit detailed that on March 16th, OPD received a call from Terrence Barbie that stated he got into an argument with his estranged wife, Mary Lynn Barbie, when they met up so she could give him some money. The two are reportedly going through a divorce. Terrence Barbie stated that in her anger, his wife got a box cutter and cut him several times on his left forearm. Terrence Barbie sought medical treatment after the assault. Mary Lynn Barbie was booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center on Tuesday and has one bond of $25,000, jail records show. She was still in custody as of Friday afternoon.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, April 19th, 2020. Section A. WTFB tries to maintain consistency. By Libby Campbell, West Texas Food Bank. There is a specific comfort in the consistency at the West Texas Food Bank's warehouse. When I wander through the racks of food and processing rooms in the cavernous warehouse, there is a constant buzz. Most times, it's the staff filling orders and processing donations. And others, at other times, it's just the hum of the HVAC system maintaining a constant temperature for the food we keep on hand. Consistency and constant are two words I hold in high esteem. The West Texas Food Bank must provide a consistent and constant service for those West Texans who need us the most. March proved to be a stress on that constant like I've never seen in the 10 years I've been the executive director. March came in like a lamb. Families were preparing to relax over the upcoming spring break, and we at the food bank were busy preparing for our annual gala event, the Forever Full Margarita Fiesta. But then things began to change. The price of oil was down, and there was an increased awareness that a virus from a distant land was making big waves throughout the world, and Texas was more than likely in its path. And then the lion came roaring in. The coronavirus alert was raised. Schools decided not to come back from spring break, and businesses began making precautions. At the food bank, I consulted with my board of directors and brought together our senior leadership team to implement our disaster plan. The decisions we made were some of the most heartbreaking decisions I've had to make in my food banking career. CDC guidelines rapidly changed, and for the health and wellness of the WTFB staff, we made the decision to stop all volunteer activities. Events and classes were canceled, including our large annual gala, and we closed the signature feature of both WTFB facilities, our client choice pantries. The number one concern was to keep the team safe, and I knew we had to take drastic measures. Essentially, WTFB was closed to the public. What you might not realize is just how much these tough decisions changed the way we do business, practically overnight. Without any volunteers, the warehouse staff had to step up to build our new pantry boxes, and because there wasn't client choice pantry, our distribution model had to change to a drive-through so that we could safely serve those in need. According to a Feeding America release, the COVID-19 pandemic has created unprecedented demand for food across the country, including demand in the charitable food distribution system. Year-over-year sales at U.S. grocery retailers is up between 80 to 200% from late February to early March due to the surge in consumer demand. This consumer demand for food has limited the Feeding America network's access to donated food, particularly shelf-stable food, which is a critical need for food banks as they prepare to ramp up low and no-contact distributions. The result of this surge is that donations of food from retail and manufacturers to food banks have declined 40 to 60%, in recent weeks, and what we are seeing at WTFB is no different. In a typical month, our drivers bring in more than 100,000 pounds of food from local grocery stores. But now, the shelves are bare, and departments are closed as staff from services such as the bakery have been reassigned to help run checkout stands, disinfect the store, and stock shelves. Customers are purchasing the bakery, deli, and dairy items that normally would be donated, and this leaves us short. We have had to strike a delicate balance between the dwindling numbers of pounds coming in and the increasing number of pounds going out. One way we continue to meet the demand is through our purchased food program, which allows WTFB to buy shelf-stable food directly from manufacturers, often at or below cost. The availability and access these lifelines during our regular operations is crucial. But with the increased demand seen by the retail outlets, this food is proving to be difficult to acquire in a timely manner. We are using the unemployment numbers as a barometer to gauge what is in store for us. As more and more West Texans find themselves not returning to work because of the health crisis, and as more and more oil field jobs are lost, our lines will continue to get longer. We are hearing stories of workers being unable to access unemployment benefits. This is evolving into a dilemma that is leaving everyone nervous, anxious, and scared. Looking forward, I don't know what tomorrow will look like, but I do know we will continue to serve the people who need us the most, many of whom have never experienced hunger before. We have received support, both big and small, from our amazingly generous community, and for that I am thankful. West Texans always amaze me with their grace and grit, and we know this too shall pass. When this is over, you will shower the West Texas Food Bank with food drives, and you will show up to volunteer, just like you have time and time again. But for now, I ask that you stay home, stay safe, and please stay healthy. Living in Limbo Leads to Stress, Anxiety by Mark McQueen, Centers. Centers, formerly Centers for Children and Families, has provided counseling and mental health support for individuals and families for more than 60 years. In recent months, we have started conversations about expanding our services to include telehealth support. We know this is becoming a much more common practice, especially in large metropolitan areas, as well as some very rural, remote locations. We prefer to meet with clients in person and find that format to be most effective, but also understand technology, to some extent, is driving the field of counseling and mental health in a telehealth direction. In March, the strategic long-term goal of slowly introducing telehealth counseling options quickly turned into a short-term, immediate need. The coronavirus placed centers in a position of needing to find an effective way of still meeting clients' needs while at the same time adhering to local, state, and federal guidelines for distancing. Thanks to the efforts of many centers' staff, our agency of counselors are all now working from home and are equipped to provide both phone and video conferencing for the families we serve. Our lives are currently on hold, but the mental health and emotional needs of families are not. One of the things we know about stress is that we are statistically more likely to be drawn toward destructive behavior when under increased stress. Fragile areas in our lives tend to get exposed when under unusual amounts of stress. Calls to domestic violence crisis lines have increased nationwide. For families or marriages where routine conflict already existed, you can be sure that the isolation and increased time together has not lessened that tension. Some of the stress is really mere inconvenience. For example, I am ready to be able to eat at Carambas again. But there is real stress out there. I am particularly concerned about those who struggle with depression and anxiety because so many of the things we are being asked to do to help stop the spread of the virus, increased time alone, lack of exposure to support systems such as friends and faith community, and no access to hobbies that take you out of your home, are the opposite of what you would recommend for somebody struggling with a mood disorder. Isolation and depression simply don't mix. The current worldwide health crisis most definitely qualifies as increased, unusual stress. There is the direct stress of being sick or having a family member who is ill. For most of us, however, the days, now weeks, of isolation are taking their toll on even the most introverted of personalities. The lack of close contact with extended family and friends, as well as the lack of contact with coworkers and our church homes, only exacerbate the stress. There is no rhythm to life right now. How many times have you heard someone say, "I've lost all track of time and I have no idea what day it is"? And how many people are struggling with being thrown into the role of homeschooling their children, feeling unprepared and wondering if there is enough patience to make it until the end of May? How many people are working from home and miss the camaraderie of the office, or simply don't feel nearly as efficient or productive? And to make matters worse, we don't know when the world might shift back toward normal. I watched the news the other night and heard dates ranging from this May to sometime in 2022 for when this whole thing would end. This highlights a truth about anxiety. Living in limbo is more stressful than knowing what's coming next. Uncertainty about the future and anxiety don't mix well. Whether you consider your mental health need great or small, we encourage you to call Centers and request a meeting with one of our counselors. Centers is taking new clients, and our counselors will be glad to meet with you through one of our telehealth options. Centers is also aware that the economy is creating additional stress on families. As a result, we will be waiving our $50 intake fee starting Monday and continuing through the end of May. Please reach out to one of our counselors, and there will be no fee for your initial visit. If you are interested in making an appointment, call the office at 570-1084. Our modified office hours are 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Monday through Friday.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.